This is September the what? 30th, 1961, at Anchorage, Alaska, the Pioneer Convention. We got up at 7 o'clock this morning, Andrew Wicken and Jimmy McDonald and George Bijonich and myself went down and had breakfast at the pancake house, a hot cake house. We had a good feed, ham and hot cakes, sourdough hot cakes, by the way, from a starter made 74 years ago at Miller House on the Seas Highway. Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. And then after breakfast, we wandered uptown and met all the politicians. Well, I wandered over to the Westward Hotel, and I met quite a few pioneers who'd come in there and some lawyers. I met Bob Johnson and Bob Parrish and Warren Taylor, and there was a whole lot of people all around there. And then where would we go from there? Then we went from, wandered around town, went over to the business session at continuation of the convention at 2 o'clock. We had a very speedy, short session. Everything was run through in machine manner. All committee reports were turned in and closed. And then we recessed from there to get ready to go where? Oh, wait. One other thing we did. We went to the community hall, municipal community hall, and heard a talk by the General Mundy on communism, and they run a picture on the history of the oil exploration here in Alaska and gas resources. And then we went up to the Pioneer Hall after that and had our session. And then after we got out of there, at 6 o'clock tonight, we're to have another cocktail party at the Pioneer Hall. What else have we got on here, Andy? Mm-hmm. Oh, dance tonight, yes, at 9 o'clock. Dance at 9 o'clock at the Alps. Well, we'll tell you about that later when it happens. And we're sitting here in the room, Merle Thomas and Andy Wicken. Merle, what do you got to say about it?
I got to say you got 17 minutes to get to this cocktail party, and you don't get there, you're not
going
to get
there. I give all my tickets away. How am I going to get any drinks?
Take Andy.
Let's go now.
Andy says, let's go now. Now, wait a minute. I want.
Now, there's a little incident happened a while ago. Jimmy McDonald and myself were sitting in a bar down here, and we found Governor Egan coming through the back door, sneaking into the bar.
He walked out through the door and never walked in either.
Put your name on here.
I told him I said he's taking hands, but I don't go by drink, but he walked off.
Well, what's your name now? Put your name
Hello,
on.
Hello, Hart. Harry Carbon was my name.
Harry Carbon.
You and I were... George,
what's your name?
No,
put your name on here.
What is it for?
Well, listen, I'm going to play it back to you. Go ahead. You're just talking to it.
William Burns.
What's your name?
Art Lappy.
Art Lappy? Yeah. Well, now, Carl, you tell him what happened.
I did it about time this whole time.
Well, just recording, Carl. Tell him what happened. Carl, he thinks this thing's going to bite him. What is your name?
Heine Schneider.
Heine Schneider, past Grand President, and also acting chaplain this day of the convention.
No, I am...
acting historian?
No, I'm acting assistant historian.
Assistant historian. How old are you, Heine?
And I'm 75 years old.
And what year were you born?
1886.
You've been having a pretty good time here today?
Yes.
I'm going to let you hear this back, Heine.
This
is a... Charlie?
Well, yes.
What kind of a uniform you got on? What do you call this?
This is an old pioneer uniform. Get ready to go to bed uniform.
Did you go to bed up here?
I don't know. Got a good looking woman here.
Which one do you pick out?
Oh, no.
No, I'm just
Tell you that. You're all good
looking women. All right, man.
Dance and banquet ball, a
the Grand Igloo, 1961, Anchorage, Alaska.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Well, if you're going to mess your hair, there's a lot of beautiful costumes here. Reds and blacks and blues and greens. The hall is filling up now, and there's some of the seats are taken. The whole final seems to be having a good time. Mike, you want to come and look at this one now?
Huh?
Tell me what you think. What's up?
Well, I think
I'm going to... Miley,
say,
ain't you
going to
talk to me?
Yeah.
You know,
yes, I am.
Yeah.
I like now.
What do you think of it?
Well, this is a real show party. It's the nicest convention I've ever been to. Mm-hmm.
That's what I think too, Mary.
Thank you. At the moment, and the members of the cast are circulating around out here getting very nice. And the gentleman sitting next to me, what is your name, sir?
Paul Hanson from Ketchikan.
And your business?
I'm an assistant supplier there from Ketchikan.
And you've lived there?
36 years.
How old are you, sir?
60 years old.
You're 60?
I'm 60.
Oh, I don't believe it. Do you believe that?
Yeah,
but I'm older than you are. Oh, you don't believe it, huh? He's already pulled something on me, didn't he, huh? Yesterday. You know, this is getting excited, don't you?
Oh, I have no idea.
Oh, I'll make my mother.
Now, this is October the 27th, 1961, at Fairbanks, Alaska. And this is Harry Hughes with the Pioneer Tape Recorder. And we're paying a visit to Mr. and Mrs. Keefe, the former Mrs. Helen Husak, and Frank Young, her brother. Now, we start. Put your name on it.
This is Marshall Keefe, married Helen Husak, wife of the now deceased Alec Husak, whom we are going to talk about tonight.
And this is Frank Young, brother of Helen, who will try to give us a little early day history of one of the pioneer farmers of the 4th Division, Alec Husak.
And this is Helen Keefe, formerly Helen Husak. My father's name was Francis A. Young. My mother's name was Margaret Young. And I was born in Skagway, Alaska, 1904. April 14th.
How long did you stay in Skagway?
8 months.
8 months? You was quite young when you come to
that's
the
right.
Area there.
About 2 years old.
What year would that be now?
The year I came to Fairbanks?
1993. Right? Yeah. That's when the town first got
Skagway. That's right.
Now, Helen, what we'd like to do, Alec Husak was a very well-known farmer in this area. We'd like you to give a resume of your experiences and yours and his life here in the early day farming, and how you folks made out here under the food conditions, and anything of interest.
Well, I suppose you would like to know the year he came to Alaska.
Tell him, that's very interesting. That was always become a fire part how he first came into the territory, went out, and looked at Alaska.
Well, I'd like to, from the beginning, get his, he was born in Poland.
Alec was born in Poland and came to the United States as a boy of 17.
The name of the town in Poland is P-O-D.
Pohatcy.
Spell it on there, and then it'll be
P O D H A J C E. Poland.
Mm hmm. And do you remember what year it was?
He was born in March 19th, 1890. And he came to the United States at the age of 17. And stayed 2 years in the States, and then came north. He came from Tacoma, Washington, by boat to Valdez and walked from Valdez over the old Valdez Trail to Fairbanks. And he went to work in the mines, and he worked that summer. That fall, he returned to the States. They said it was so cold he'd freeze if he stayed up here, so he was afraid to stay. So he went back. And the next spring, he came back to Alaska again. He walked in again over the Valdez Road. And then he stayed and worked in the mines for 2 years. And he bought a team of horses and started hauling wood to the mine.
You remember what mines those were?
Yes, he worked for Henry Wagner, Wise Mike Stepovich, and all different ones that were mining on Last Chance, Fairbanks Creek, Pedro Creek, Delmore.
In that area.
In that area. Mm-hmm. And he delivered wood. He hauled wood for the mines for a few years, and gradually got more horses.
That was the only fuel in those years here, was wood.
Yeah, all the boilers were had wood. Later, he came into Fairbanks and contracted with the NC Company to furnish him all the wood for their boilers, for the lights and everything. And he had wood cutters up on Steel Creek cutting wood, and he hauled. He had 6 and 8 head of horses hauling. And in 1920, he started farming on the old Blaine place back at the University of Alaska. He rented that, and he farmed there for 2 summers. And then he moved on the old Jim McIntyre place, which is still the Husak farm. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my son Jack lives there now. And we lived there for 20 years. Farming.
And what did you raise?
Well, mostly potatoes and grain. But all vegetables.
How was the market? Was it considered successful?
No, very poor for many years. No.
How did you support your brother? The local stores?
The local stores and restaurants and the family, people. Well, of course, when the military moved in, then things changed. Then we couldn't furnish the market. We could sell all we could raise and then more.
And your first crop at that time was potatoes?
Potatoes. Oh, 250, 300 tons. Mm-hmm. Oh, he was always experimenting with grains and potatoes, bringing potatoes. He brought potatoes from Canada to see how they'd work here. And he was always trying to work with different grains, finding the kind that would be suitable for this climate. And he was always working with the experimental station, Dr. Gasser.
And he did work out there, too.
Oh, no, he didn't work out there, but he was always
consulting
with them and cooperating with them.
Who else do you remember in that time that Alex cooperated with in this area? What other farmers?
Oh, Jim McGrath, gentleman, and Frank Burchard. He was raising grains, different grains.
How about stock?
Chickens? Well, we always had horses.
Horses?
And we always had pigs and chickens and a cow.
Where's that?
Oh, yeah.
Well,
and the whole farm was 320. But,
Now, during all this period, Alec was cooperating with the United States Department of Agriculture and the local state university in all these agricultural experiments.
That's right.
And you say he was testing new grains, new potatoes, trying out new ideas?
Yes, he was at all times.
And was he checking on soil conservation?
He was the first one to take samples of the soil and take it to Seattle to have it analyzed.
He was the very first one who tried that in this country?
That's right. To find out just what fertilizers he should use for different kinds of soil.
Well, what was the overall result of these experiments? Did it improve? Did it show definite improvement on his crop compared to other crops throughout the country?
It showed improvements on all the farmers because they all started using the different, better fertilizers, the fertilizer that was suitable for the ground. And it showed up in the crops right away. The potatoes were better, cooked up better, and was a better grade.
Then Alec made it a point to see that everybody got the benefit as a result of his experimentation.
Oh, yes. He was always glad to talk to anyone, show them anything he knew or tell them.
Helen, you told me that Alec was active in the origin here of the rural electrification and your farmers' co-op. How did that come about?
He was the first one to sign up for the Golden Valley to come in here. And he was on the board of directors of that for quite some time. And he was also one of the first ones to start the Panama Valley Farmers' Co-op. And he was on the board of directors of that until he died.
Didn't you tell me one time that Alec and you had the first phone on the Farmer's Loop Road, too?
Yes. We had the first phone. He had to put in his own poles. He and Charlie McGrath and Herb DeStacia cut their poles and put them up, furnished their own wire and their own transformers. And then the city gave us the phone, the service out there.
Oh, it was the city at that time. Was there that then was...
No,
that is still furnished by the city.
That's right.
Was that the time that NC still owned the plant? Or was it after the city took over the utilities?
Well, now that must be... The NC must have still owned it then.
I think it was. The NC still
owned
the plant.
Well, now, it seems to me, Helen, that you told me one time that Alec had another experience with telephone poles. Didn't he cut all the poles for the completion of the line clear to the Canadian border? Would you tell us about that?
That was in 1943. He took a contract to get the poles out from here to the Canadian border to furnish the poles for the whole line.
And how did he do that, Helen?
He took horses and one small cat and a crew of men and moved right along just as he'd cut them out. He'd move on to the next patch.
And how did they live?
They took a small Wanigan, hauled it with them. And they had bunks in it, and they'd move when they'd get one patch cut off, they'd just move along. And at one time, he ran out of horse feed, and the army had to fly baled hay in and drop it to him.
Did you go with him on these trips?
Not on that one, no.
He cut all the poles for the power lines clear to the Canadian border, is that correct?
That's right.
That was known as the Army Communications System.
Now, Helen, let me ask you about some of the pioneer farmers on the Farm Loop Road. Do you remember Seacock?
Oh, yes. What was his first name? Cyprian Seacock.
And you remember Claus Johnson?
Oh, very well, yes. We worked back and forth. Alec did work for him, and he did work for us at times.
And let me see, there was other pioneer farmers on that loop that I can't recall.
There was George Dana, Lou Joy's brother-in-law. There was Bert Stimple, Cox, and DeJordan, and Dave Atwell, and numerous other ones that I can't recall at the time.
Helen, now I'll ask you about the the Farm Loop Road in regards to in the days when you folks first moved out on the farm. The so-called Farm Loop Road didn't go all the way around to the university, that is, the college area. Mm-hmm. At that time?
Long before I moved up there.
It went all
right
around.
Along.
But the road itself was a pretty tough go, wasn't it?
Just two muddy ruts.
I know one time we went out with an old-time Chevrolet car, and I think it was 5 or 6 hours making it from town here to the farm.
Well, it was just 5 miles to our gate from the post office, and we figured in those days it was a day's trip, a good day's trip to come in and go out.
What is it today?
10 minutes. Today it's
only
10 minutes
trip.
10 minutes trip.
Well, I understand they're going to pave your Farmers Loop Road this next year and straighten it out also.
That's what we're hoping for, and they say they are.
From all the history that we can get of Alec, it appears that he was a far-sighted man. Where you are now developing what is known as Hoosac Acres, he bought that with the idea in mind years ago that eventually it would become a successful housing development. Is that correct?
Yes, he had that in mind many years ago.
Was that his idea in buying that property?
No, his main idea in buying the property was the farm. But he had set aside that portion of it to have it surveyed. In fact, he had it surveyed, started to have it surveyed, into acre lots, which he intended to sell and make into a housing project.
How many years ago was that, Helen?
12 years ago.
That was at a time when everybody thought the Farmers Loop Road was right out in the wilderness.
That's correct.
But with his vision, he could foresee the development of this community to the point where that would be an active suburban development area.
He often told me several times, that someday that farm would be right in the city. That Fairbanks would grow to such an extent that that farm would be right in the city.
Well, that certainly shows vision on his part, along with his experimental work. Helen, at the time that you and Alec first started the farm out there, your living conditions, you stated, were a little bit crude. Did you have any well or any modern conveniences of any nature?
None whatever. We hauled all our water, except in the summertime we caught rainwater.
From the roof?
From the roof. And we had gas lanterns for light. And we had, of course, no bathroom facilities or anything like that.
Now, give a routine day, what you did in the morning and when you got up. And what you did during the day?
Well, we got up about 5:30 in the morning. And the first thing, of course, was the sourdough hotcakes every morning. And there was always plenty of work, of course, to be done on a farm.
What did you eat with the hotcakes?
Well, we had our own bacon. and fresh eggs, and milk, fresh milk, and,
And after breakfast, what did you do?
Well, the men went to the fields, of course. There was always work to be done there. And if I wasn't too busy, I went and hauled a little water. And sometimes helped in the garden. And
didn't you also, at that time, develop a wayside vegetable stand?
Well, that was later. That wasn't in the very early years. That was in later years after we started to raise more vegetables. We had a roadside stand.
And you had your, buying your groceries now, you'd come in and buy them in bulk.
Yes, always in bulk. In that way, we didn't have to make so many trips.
Well, after breakfast and you, the men went to work, what was your daily routine?
Oh, there was washing to be done and cooking to be done. Of course, we always had a big crew in the spring and fall.
Because, Helen, you had such a short growing season?
Yes, you could only take around 100 days from the time you planted until you had to have it out of the ground.
And where did you get your help?
Local help from here in town. Both men and women worked there.
But did neighbors help each other like we used to do in the early days?
Yes, they were very good about that. If anyone was stuck or was getting late in the fall and they were afraid they were going to lose anything, they'd all give a hand to help them.
Well, what did you do about lunchtime?
Well, they were generally close enough to the house to come in at lunchtime.
You have an old bell on the back porch you'd ring for them when it's time to come to lunch?
No, I didn't. They generally knew.
They generally got hungry.
They got hungry about noon and came in, yes.
Well, now, in later years, after the military moved in here, did you get some help from them on your harvest?
Almost entirely, soldiers worked on the farm.
How did you get them?
Through the Army, we just sent word how many boys we'd need, and they would send out so many every day, a different crew every day, giving all the boys a chance to make that money.
Now, you said that you raised pigs. Did you raise any commercial stock for sale, resale, or just for your own consumption?
No, he raised pork for sale.
Where did he get food for a number of pigs?
Well, at first he got it from Ladd Field. He was allowed to haul it from Ladd Field.
That'd be their garbage.
Yes. And then later on, when Site 2, just a half a mile below us, was started, he was permitted to go in there and get their garbage.
In other words, you served a double pork purpose. You eliminated the garbage from the field and fed your pigs at the same time.
That's correct.
Now, at that time, Helen, your only power on the farm then was horses. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Well, where did you get the horses?
Well, they were shipped in from the States.
Did Alex ship them in himself, generally?
Sometimes, and sometimes he bought them. He bought a team once from Kramer's, and sometimes he shipped them. He told me once he had 42 horses buried up on the farm in the corner of the field.
That's horses that had died off in service?
That's right.
42. Mm-hmm. Well, now, you had the cow, you say, was that for your own use?
Yes, just for our own use, for the milk for the children.
And chickens?
Yeah, we always had a few chickens, not too many.
What did your family consist of at that time, Helen, when you were there with Harry?
My mother and two children.
Didn't you have a very faithful old retainer that lived with you and Alec for many, many years?
Tony Grigolis lived with us for 20 years.
Now, where is Tony now?
He's in the Pioneer's home at Sitka. He had a paralytic stroke.
And Tony was with you for many years?
20 years.
20 years.
Now, later in the day, when they start to come in the evening, what was your routine then? Because I'm going to lead up to something.
Well, we just had a big table loaded down with plenty of fresh vegetables and either fresh pork or chickens or moose meat.
Vegetables?
All kinds of fresh vegetables.
What did you have for dessert? Salad.
Oh, we had plenty for salad. And, we had pies and cakes. And
did you do a lot of canning in those days, Helen?
Yes, we did. We canned most of the vegetables. All kinds of vegetables.
And you had that for your winter vegetables?
That's right.
Well, now, how about wild meat? Did you get moose and caribou?
Oh, yes. We always had moose and caribou in the wintertime.
Did you go with Alec and Jack on these hunts?
Yes, every fall.
Who did the killing, you or Alec?
Alec or Jack. When I first moved on the farm, there was lots of grouse out there. There was no trouble, and lots of rabbits. We could just walk down to the road early in the morning and get all the grass you wanted.
In season, did you save the rabbit first?
No, we never did save the rabbit first.
Well, during the migratory period of the birds now, the ducks and the geese and the crane, I suppose your grain fields were very...
Oh, yes, they would there. See, lots of them on the fields. Cranes, geese, in the fall when they'd be going out, you'd see them in the spring when they'd come.
Were they good eating, too?
You mean the... Now, wait a minute.
Especially those sandhill cranes. But you know now, Helen, that they've finally taken the restrictions off that and they're legal this year.
Is that so? I hadn't heard.
That's a little different than it was when you had to sneak down in the field and hide behind a bush for 14 hours.
Ah, you're just making that up.
Well, you told me that.
Now, Helen, to get back to the farming out on the... on your old farm out there, Alec used to raise a considerable amount of cabbage for sauerkraut, didn't you?
Yeah, the last year he planted cabbage, he had 10,000 heads.
10,000 heads?
Of cabbage.
And what did he do with that?
Well, what he couldn't sell, when the cabbage, the cracked heads, he put into sauerkraut. He made put it into 50-gallon barrels.
And did he sell that commercially?
Oh, to the restaurants here in town and the grocery stores.
They did have trouble with cracked heads because the cabbage grows so fast here.
That's it.
Well, that's a point in agriculture here that newer people don't understand, and those things we want to try to get on the table.
Yeah, everything grows very fast and very large. And he had quite a reputation for making his sauerkraut, good sauerkraut.
What was the average weight of a cabbage head?
Oh, 14, 15 pounds, I think, yeah.
15 pounds
head. I've seen 20 pounds.
Is there anything else besides the cabbages and the bulb type vegetables that grow here? How about the pumpkins and squash?
Oh, they grow wonderful squash.
And the cucumbers?
Oh, yes. Not outdoors.
Not outdoors. They have to be grown in the greenhouse. Well, did you have a greenhouse?
Not at that time. We do have now. Any vegetable that grows, like a cabbage or a turnip, as soon as the nights get dark, that's when they start putting on the sides.
When the nights get dark,
that's when they start growing fast.
Getting towards the late season and they start growing fast.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is that funny?
It is, huh?
But that's a fact, too. I know what you're telling me is the truth.
Yes, it is.
See, I planted the garden years ago for the cabin, too. Exactly. I have rhubarb growing wild.
One year we grew corn. We tried it. 90-day corn. And it grew all right. It was very tasty, very sweet. But it didn't grow very large.
Now, I'm going to turn this tape. So this is the end of the first side of this tape. We'll turn the tape over. This is side number two of this reel of Helen and Mark.
Helen, on Alec's grain experimentations, how much progress did he make in that line?
Well, he did fairly well, especially with his wheat. At one time, they had a small mill here, and they milled flour and made bread. In fact, I baked bread made out of the flour.
Do you remember who run that mill? Remember the people that run the mill?
No, I don't.
Well, did that flour... compare favorably with your commercial flours in the market?
Oh, yes. It made very fine bread, only it was a darker flour. It wasn't white like the flour you buy now.
It wasn't bleached?
No.
Well, then, did Alec grow quite a lot of grain?
Yes, he sold a lot of grain to different men that had horses around the country. In fact, he delivered hay. Oh, he used to haul hay to Esther Creek and up to Clary Summit and all different places.
Well, that'd be a 2 or 3 day trip sometimes, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You take a load of hay and go 2 or 3 days to make a delivery, they wouldn't know what that is today.
No.
And you did this delivering in the wintertime?
In the fall, generally. But during the winter months, they'd come out and buy bundled hay. He'd cut his hay, you know, with a binder, and it'd be all in bundles and be shocked. And he'd put in what he could, what was matured enough to put in. And he'd sell that hay during the winter months to different ones. And of course, he always had 6 head of horses he had to feed.
They didn't have a baler. Explain that bundle.
Well, he cut it with a binder, and it was in the bundle. They had the shop.
In bundles, not in bales.
No, not in bales, just in bundles tied with
the
string.
There was no bale in Alaska, no.
Well, did you raise strawberries out there, too?
Yes, we did. And did very well with the strawberries.
Commercially?
Well, yes. We had, he sold strawberries, and we had all we wanted to eat. I don't remember just what he charged, but I remember the first year that he had any of any to any amount, he sold $600. So, you know, he had quite a pet.
Well, was it feasible to fly or ship grain? Well, of course, in those days you couldn't fly grain in. What happened if you didn't have enough hay for your stock?
Well, you could always buy baled hay at the NC store.
Wasn't that pretty expensive?
It was expensive, and the horses didn't like it as well either. But it could be bought if you were really in need. Of course, he always had plenty after he started raising his own.
Well, what about the wild berries? Cranberries, blueberries?
Oh, yes, there was current. Always an abundance of berries.
The wild currant up there, too?
Red currant.
Red currant, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And black currants. Along that Isabel Creek, there was always black currants. And plenty of high bush and low bush cranberries, blueberries, raspberries.
Was the salmonberry ever this far in Alaska?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Salmonberries here, too?
Oh, yeah.
I see them on the coast, but I never see them in here.
There used to be lots of salmonberries out on Gilmore.
Did Alec ever engage in anything but just the agricultural work after he got into farming?
Oh, yes. Every winter he logged.
Just right there.
He logged for the Independent Lumber Company for a number of years. He'd take horses and men, probably 6 or 8 men, and 6 or 8 head of horses, and he'd go to different spots in the wintertime and cut the logs and haul them out.
Did you go with him on these trips?
I went 2 or 3 times, yes. We went up one winter to Smallwood.
You move out there with your equipment and set up camp?
Mm-hmm. That's right, set up camp, and they'd have to build a barn. That was important for the horses. And they'd have some tents and some cabins.
No power equipment of any kind?
Not at that time, no. No, that was strictly all running.
Well, now, how long would it take to get your equipment from here to Small Creek?
Smallwood, it took us 2 days with about 4 loads, 4 big loads. And we'd make Frank Miller's Roadhouse the first night, and then stay overnight there, and then go on to Smallwood.
Give the location of that roadhouse.
It's on the Chena.
How far
out of town? It's on the Little Chena. It's about 17 miles from here.
That was a 2-day trip to get out there?
One day there.
1 day there.
And then go on to Smallwood the next one. And the last winter we were up there, I can just think of their names now. There was Bill McCon and Dan Kelly and Tony Grigolis and Earl Young and several others that I just can't recall. And also there was Hospital Charlie. It was known as Hospital Charlie. He was with us. He had worked in St. Joseph's Hospital here off and on for a number of years, and that's how he came by that name. He worked for us off and on for years and finally died on the farm. While we were on Smallwood, Roy Ferguson came up with his dog team to see how the logging was coming on. He was manager for the Independent Lumber Company. And so I came back with him in the dog team to town and stayed a few days and then hired a dog team to go back up to the logging camp again. And then we didn't come out until the last of April. We had a couple of rivers. We had to cross the water, the rivers, with the horses.
The ice was breaking up then.
The ice was gone then, yes. The water was high.
Mm-hmm. How did they handle the logs? Did they take and drag them over to the river and put them in the river?
Yes, they all came down the river. Down the
they hauled them off from back in the woods through the river.
Yes, he hauled them out to the river.
They used the horses with go devils to drag them out from the river and dump them in the river?
They just
hook on the log and drag it on the ground.
Right along. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the horses were so used to it that you could just hook on and start them off in the way they'd go. They knew just which way to go. And
they knew better what to do than the driver did.
That's right.
Now, some of the other places that you logged, You and Alex worked in the early days. You mentioned about down the highway at 34 Mile and down by Silver Fox.
Yes, you logged just the other side of the Silver Fox.
That's 49 miles from Fairmax.
That's right.
And the 34 Mile?
He also logged in there, and he logged 19 miles up the old Richardson Highway. Off of the highway in there.
There used to be trees where there's none today.
That's right.
Who were some of the people that lived along there that you met in those years? Who lived along that old trail?
Well, there was the 18 Mile Roadhouse, which at that time was run by the Mutchlers, and later by Frank Turner and his wife. We used to stop there.
And there was that roadhouse a little bit.
It was an old log structure, and it was.
First built by Ed Sullivan and his wife.
They later moved up on the Delta and built a roadhouse there, and is known in the early days as the Sullivan Roadhouse on the cutoff. That is now, at least it was built just this side of Delta, and the trail in them days, it, instead of going around by Birch Lake, it went to the right of Birch Lake and went on up through and hit the Tanana and followed the Tanana along until it hit the Delta coming down, and then went along where Donnelly Dome is today, and all over Donnelly Dome and on into the Paxton country.
Thank you, Frank.
Coming back down the line. His
farming in the last years of his life was quite successful, and he had the satisfaction of knowing that he finally had accomplished a great deal with it. And his health started failing, and passed away in July of 1952 here in Fairbanks.
Didn't he always believe that there was a great future for agriculture in this country?
He always believed there was a great future for agriculture in the Tanana Valley.
As most of us believe.
As most of us do believe and hope.
Well, thank you for that portion, Helen. And I'll terminate this part of this story for now. And this will be a part of Igloo Four's Pioneer History, recorded by Harry Hughes. And in the room were Helen, Frank, and Marsh, and Harry Hughes. Okay?
This is a little added information in regard to Helen's story here on the tape, and she'll continue.
Louis St. Louis owned the 9 Mile Roadhouse. He built it and lived there on it for a good many years.
That's 9 miles from Fairbanks.
9 miles from Fairbanks.
These mileposts and these numbers on these roadhouses are not always true. Sometimes they're 9 miles or 10 miles from another direction. So it's kind of nice to get the correct location on the tape.
It was just 9 miles from Fairbanks. On the old Richardson Trail, yeah.
Now, tell me a little more about it. Remember more about it?
Well, we have stopped there overnight on our way.
What do you do for entertainment in the evening? How about these famous dances and get-togethers I heard about?
You mean here in Fairbanks?
In this area, yes.
Oh, yes, they had, in the winter months especially, they had dances.
Was any of them that you went to that you can remember and just had on there?
Yeah, I remember the big tombola. They used to have a for the hospital benefit once a year. And then they used to have masquerade every New Year's. Masquerade ball.
And people come from miles around.
Well, yes. Everyone would come in, especially from the cliques and all over, for the dances in the wintertime. And I remember when the railroad bill went through, I was a small girl, and they had two or three dances going for two or three days every night, celebrating.
Where did they hold up?
The Eagle Hall and the Old Moose Hall and the Masonic Hall.
And
they sing and dance and have a good time. Is that it?
Well, yeah, regular dances.
Yes, something to eat?
No, they didn't generally have any refreshments. Just.
Did you have quite a celebration here on the 4th of July?
Oh, yes. When I was a child, a celebration on the 4th of July lasted 3 days. They built a big grandstand down near where the new bridge is now, down to the Fairview Hotel. And all the mines would shut down. The miners would all come in from the creeks and the people. The town would be crowded, and it'd be hard to get a room in a hotel in this town during that celebration. Yeah, 3rd, 4th, and 5th. They'd have all kinds of races, children's races, and tug-of-war. Even had horse races on Front Street.
Well, was this Chattanooga Railroad and this Chena Railroad running when you were here? Do you remember anything?
Oh, yes. I've ridden on both of them. I used to ride down to Chena from here.
Tell us about them.
Well, I used to go down there quite often with another girlfriend. Her father was ran the Times newspaper here. He was editor of the Times newspaper, Roy Southworth. And he had one daughter, Margaret. And she and I used to go down to Chena to visit a lady that lived there. We'd go on that old train.
Now, that's how far from town?
About 12 miles.
The road bed was about 12 miles to get there.
That's right.
And about how many people lived there?
Oh, at that time, there wasn't very many. That was back in about 1914 or 15.
That's when the town was gradually getting smaller.
Gradually going down, yes. Mm-hmm.
But that used to be the river port.
Yes, Chena at one time was quite a town.
It was really a river port, though, a river boat.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
There was no other interest there outside of transportation.
No.
There's no mining immediately around it.
No. Not that I ever knew.
And it's located at the junction of the Tanana
right,
and
the Chena
Slough.
That's right. The Chena goes to Tanana. Mm-hmm. That's right there.
The nearest mining was located over at Esther, 8 or 10 miles across the
And then the train to Chattanooga, that was quite a trip.
Do you remember a fellow the name of Frank that had a roadhouse on the Tanana River about 30 miles from town, 27 miles from town?
Eat 'em up, Frank?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
Can you tell us about that?
Well, I remember him. I remember stopping there when I was going to Nenana on a launch with Roy Lund when I was about 12, 13 years old.
Who was the engineer on that boat? Do you remember?
On the launch?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Roy Lund.
He was running the boat.
He was running the boat, yes. Uh-huh.
Well, how did Frank get that name? Eat 'em up, Frank.
Well, perhaps Frank here can tell you more about that than I can. I don't know. He used to say eat up.
Well, eat 'em up, Frank got that name. He used to. He used to make home brew here in the early days, and when he'd get a certain amount of that. Concoction into him, why he'd jump up and down and holler, "I'll eat you up." So anyway, he picked up that name of Eat 'em Up Frank, and it stuck to him on down through the years. Everybody knew Eat 'em Up Frank up and down the Tanana.
This is Harry again. Well, this is the story I heard of Eat 'em Up Frank, that the riverboat people used to stop there, and he didn't serve very much of anything except hotcakes, and he'd cook big stacks of hotcakes, and he didn't want to throw them out, so he'd request that everybody clean them up or he'd throw them out, feed them to the dogs, and he'd always say, "Clean them up, eat them up, Frank." That's how I heard that he got his name. Now, how much of that is true, Frank?
Well, I don't know. I heard different stories. I one time got this Frank I said, "Frank, now, how did you ever get this name of Eat 'em Up Frank?" "Well," he said, "I'll tell you." He said, "If I was to tell you the truth, you wouldn't believe it anyway." "Well," I said, "let's hear it." "Well," he said, "I'll tell you. You know, I was shipwrecked," he said, "down in the West Indies. And he said there was three of us got ashore on a small island there. And he says there was a colored guy and another Swede like myself. And after we was there for quite a number of days, why, he said the Swede died, and we was, it was just the colored guy and myself. So he says I finally decided I'd do away with the colored guy and eat him up." Well, I said, did you do that? He said, no, I didn't do it, but he says everybody thought I did. He said they found the colored guy years later. And he said, that's how I got the name. I said,
that's another story about him.
Well, that's the story he told me.
Mm-hmm. I visit with him a couple of times when I run up down the river in a boat here. That's how I come to meet him. But he was planting his potato patch when I stopped there to visit with him. He was out working in the yard. He's quite old. Do you remember his full name, Frank?
No, let's see. Eat 'em up Frank's correct name was Frank Lindbergh.
You remember the colored boy's name that he told about?
No, I can't recall the colored boy's name, but I officiated at Frank's funeral in about 1951.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the other old pioneer that lived across the river down this way from him? There's one lived down this way about 4 or 5 miles. I stopped to visit him too when he was alive.
Hamley?
I believe that's the name, yeah.
I can't recall him.
But he had a cabin about 5 miles down the river this way from Frank's place. I stopped there to visit with him. Oh, that's 20 years ago. Mm-hmm.
Frank Hamley? No.
I remember...
It was his dog. It was his dog. Well, that old-timer, his name was Norman Hadley, and he's still down in his little cabin.
He's still living on the other side of the river?
He's
on the other side where I met him.
Yeah, well, now he's on this side.
He's moved over on this side of the river.
Yeah, he lives in the cabin owned by, it used to belong to Pfeiffer, old Pfeiffer, the fisherman.
Yeah, I remember him, too, when he used to bring fish up here to that town.
Norman Hadley's still alive.
He was running up and down the river when I used to run up and down the river here, too. This is just a little added information on the tape of incidents in Helen's story of Alec Hoosick. Frank, there was another man lived down here at the mouth of the Tina River, below a couple of miles, the name of Martin. What do you remember about him, Martin and his fish? I visited him in those years, too. He had a lot of dogs, a lot of fish hung up.
I can't recall Martin.
You see the pictures of him in my album.
Well, maybe if I seen the picture of him, I might be able to remember him and tell you a little something about him, but I just offhand can't place him.
But there wasn't very many people living along the river because I went for hours and hours and didn't see a soul. There was only 3 or 4 people lived between here and Indiana, with the exception of a native village at the mouth of Wood River. And I stopped there, and there was no men in camp. There was a lot of kids and women there, and they couldn't talk very good, and they were shy, and I couldn't get any satisfaction out of them. So I just moved on. But evidently the men were out hunting or trapping or doing something else. And then my next stop on that first trip I made down was the mission. And I visited with that priest that had the mission at Nenana. Do you remember him?
No, there's several of them that can't be called.
I made it in exactly 6 hours running time from Fairbanks to Nenana with that first trip I made. And I had 2 fellows with me, a load of lumber and all their luggage in this boat.